I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community and region with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week we welcome back to these microphones El Nuevo Herald reporter Melissa Sanchez, who covers the city of Miami. Melissa, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
The South Florida Sun-Sentinel's lead columnist, Michael Mayo, is also with us. He's been with us almost since the start of this program 4 years ago. Welcome back, Mr. Mayo.
Hello, Phil.
And Craig Pittman is a newcomer. He is with the Tampa Bay Times and with Slate.com. He joins us from his perch in, where, St. Petersburg, Craig?
St. Petersburg, yes.
Welcome, Craig. Good to have you with us. And
thank you.
Craig is a whole series of stories on Slate.com that have been appearing on that website about weird Florida. And we're going to talk about that with him a bit later in the show and a whole bunch of other stuff that he covers. And, of course, we're gathering your input and feedback along the way. We've got a live blog going on our website, WLRN.org. We've got the Facebook page, which you can join, the Florida Roundup on WLRN. And we're also always tweetable, doing a lot of tweeting, at WLRN is our call sign, and we'll also be responding to some messages there. Of course, right now, we are right at the conclusion of the trial that has made us all think about the state of race relations in the city, the state, and the nation. We are waiting for the prosecution's rebuttal. As we speak now, the bulk of the trial has already been, the testimony, the statement, closing statements have now been complete on both sides. And the jury will soon have the case of George Zimmerman, accused of second-degree murder in the death of Miami Gardens teenager Trayvon Martin. Now, yesterday, the prosecution presented its closing argument as to why Zimmerman should be convicted of second-degree murder or manslaughter in the death of Martin last February.
Unfortunately, because his assumptions were wrong, Trayvon Benjamin Martin no longer walks on this earth. And that is true because of the actions of one individual, the man before you, the defendant, George Zimmerman. This defendant made the wrong assumption. He profiled him as a criminal. He assumed certain things, that Trayvon Martin was up to no good. And that is what led to his death.
That is Prosecutor Bernie DeLarionda yesterday during the prosecution's closing statements. Now, this morning, Friday morning, here's a portion of the defense's closing statements as lead defense attorney Mark O'Meara went after the state's case on the grounds that there remains reasonable doubt about Zimmerman's intentions as to what occurred on the night of February 26, 2012.
Because you can argue, and the state will, all you want, that George wanted to be a cop. And George's calls to law enforcement in the past just had some seething anger build up, but don't assume it. Prove it, believe it. Don't prove it, it just doesn't exist. And don't connect those dots if they've not been connected to you beyond a reasonable doubt by the state.
O'Meara said even if the standard was reversed, that the defense had to prove innocence beyond a reasonable doubt, that Zimmerman would still be not guilty. He also stipulated it was Trayvon Martin who was the aggressor in the confrontation that led to his death.
Out of the darkness, be it bushes or darkness or left or behind or somewhere, Trayvon Martin came towards George Zimmerman. Out of this. And we know what happened. The big picture is what happened.
Mike Mayo, you spent the morning watching some of the defense's closing statements. Where did you do that, and what was the reaction?
Well, I went up to Northwest Fort Lauderdale, which is a predominantly black neighborhood, and I spent some time talking to some folks at a barbershop, the New Era Barbershop, and you know, it was pretty fascinating what I found. That there was general agreement that the state might have overreached and overcharged George Zimmerman with the second-degree murder charge. But there's also a feeling that justice will not be served unless there is some sort of conviction on manslaughter that that George Zimmerman should pay for what he did. And then a little bit more disturbing is also the undercurrent of that if there is a acquittal, there is going to be some trouble in terms of some very, very visceral emotions. And, you know, one man I talked to said he had a bet going with a neighbor. He lives in Lauderhill, and it wasn't on whether it was going to be a you know, acquittal or conviction, but the bet was whether there would be riots or not. So basically, they're both assuming that there is going to be an acquittal, which
there is a perception now that things are going to move quickly, and that this is an open and shut case, and there will be an acquittal. You hear it on the TV networks. All the legal analysts are saying that this is going to be hard to get a conviction here. Is there a perception, Mike, do you think, that this is an open and shut case?
I don't know if it's an open and shut case. I mean, there's just so much at play here between the... You know, I think the prosecution did a reasonably good job yesterday of in terms of setting up what actually happened during the 2 minutes, 3 minutes in dispute of when the confrontation began and where was George Zimmerman. I mean, there was a lot of good questions raised about, like, you know, why did the screaming suddenly stop when the gunshot rang out? Why wasn't there, you know, blood? How, if he was carrying that gun holstered on his back hip, if he was pinned to the ground, how could he reach behind and get to it and fire that shot? You know, the thing seems to be leading up to that it may have been George Zimmerman on top and who was pointing that gun at Trayvon and just point blank fired it into him. Again, though, it because reasonable doubt is the standard and that this self-defense law in Florida is so lenient, it is a tough road to hoe for a conviction.
On Facebook, Drew comments said that when the 911 dispatcher told Zimmerman to stay away, doesn't that prove that he was the aggressor?
I think it does prove that he was the aggressor. I think the facts laid out pretty clearly show it. The problem is the law, as given in Florida now, does not prohibit aggressors from occupying public spaces. You know, if there was something in the self-defense law saying this doesn't apply to people who provoke or act in an aggressive manner, then it would be, you know, pretty clear that he violated the law. But it doesn't. If you're allowed to be in a space, and both of them were allowed to be on that public sidewalk, then, you know, he really has no duty to retreat, George Zimmerman. So that's the problem with the law as it stands, as I see it.
Jose in Miami says, I've kept an open mind but the more I found out about Zimmerman's lies, about his knowledge of Stand Your Ground and his never-ending desire to be a law enforcement officer, the more I was convinced he thought himself to be above the law and capable of executing his own form of law. Now, just specifically on what Mike touched on, now, Melissa, I want to ask you this. You've gotten off the phone with a few people that you know about this. And is too much being made about the reaction to the verdict, assuming that it's not guilty? Is there a false assumption that we've got a history of riots in this community related to race and that something is bound to happen?
I think maybe that's so, because in some of the previous riots that Miami has seen, the perpetrator has been the police, and in this case it's another individual. And so even though race is definitely the undertone here, who would people be rioting against? You can't go riot against Miami police, Miami-Dade police. The court isn't, the judicial processes aren't happening here, they're happening in Sanford. So That's one of the big differences between the possibilities here and what we've seen in the past with McDuffie or with the Wynwood riots.
But it would be a general,
yeah, Mike.
It would be general. I guess a protest against the system and how a legal system. You know, what kind of country are we living in when an unarmed youth can just be walking back to his father's home with a bag of candy and just end up getting shot dead, and the person who does the shooting faces no consequences. And I think that's what, you know, is so troubling and why it could be more of a widespread reaction, not necessarily against a local thing. And again, Trayvon Martin was a local youth. He was from Miami Gardens. He was just up there visiting his dad at the time. And, you know, the other thing I was talking about with Phil before the show is just logistically, timing-wise, schedule-wise, you couldn't ask for a possibly worse time to have a incendiary trial and an incendiary verdict than in the middle of the summer when all the kids, you know, the high school kids are off now for the summer. And then also the way it's shaking down is that the deliberations are going to begin going into the weekend. So conceivably we could have a verdict reached and announced on a Saturday night. A summer Saturday night is basically, to me, the perfect recipe for when bad things could happen. So I don't know. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I hope everybody keeps a level head, which is part of what the BSO and Sheriff Scott Israel and Broward has kind of reached out to local pastors and trying to keep things, everybody level-headed. But you never know what can happen.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Mike Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Melissa Sanchez from El Nuevo Herald, Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times. I want to bring Craig into the conversation because you were listening to this from afar, and obviously the connection with the state, but being up in the Bay Area, how is it seen there? Is there an expectation that something could happen when the verdict comes down, Craig?
Well, I think there's always that possibility. Certainly when we had a police officer who shot a black teenager here in St. Petersburg several years ago, there was rioting the night that it happened, and then 2 weeks later when the grand jury report came back and absolved the officer of any wrongdoing, there was further rioting that night as well. So, of course, there's that possibility. I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know what's going to happen.
And as preparations for a public reaction, Mike mentioned the Broward Sheriff's Office, they're out front on this, and they produced this public service announcement aimed at youth and urging calm.
Raise your voice.
And not your hands.
We need to stand together as one. No cuffs, no guns.
Let's give violence a rest, because we can easily end up arrested.
I know your patience will be tested, but law enforcement has your back.
Let's back up and choose not to act up, and deputies are with us, so no need to act tough.
Let it roll off your shoulders. It's water off your back. Don't lack composure, because in one instance, it could be over.
So let's make the choice to raise your voice and not your hands.
I'm Sheriff Scott Israel, and law enforcement does have your back.
And so there you go, what you were talking about, Mike. This is from Laverne in Miami. She says, I think that both sides have done and are doing a very poor job in trying to convince the American people as well as the jury that it was either self-defense or second-degree murder. The best thing for both parties to do at this point is to negotiate and go for manslaughter. Now, how much has race played a role in this trial? And I guess one thing that we heard, and Craig, you pointed this out, and in fact, in one of your Weird Florida stories, the cracker, the use of the word cracker, just in general, but Trayvon Martin apparently had used that. Is it playing out kind of the way we thought it was going to, but or is race really not a factor here?
Well, I think race is a factor as far as the public perception of what's going on. Whether that's going to play into what the jury does is another question entirely. And I noticed that the prosecutor felt the need to point out to the jury in his closing argument that regardless of the educational level of some of the witnesses, that didn't mean that their evidence was bad and that they should pay attention to what those people said. But yes, Trayvon Martin, clearly seeing Zimmerman behind him, describe him as, can I say this on the radio, a creepy-ass cracker. And so there was some people writing that, oh, in Florida, cracker is a point of pride. And my column was just to point out that, yes, if you describe yourself that way, then perhaps it is. But if you put that modifier creepy-ass in front of it, I don't think it was intended as a compliment. In fact, I think it was intended as there's somebody bad following me.
All right. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times. And if you have not had a chance, log on to Slate.com and read his series of stories about weird Florida. We're going to get into that a little bit later on. Meanwhile, we will take a break right now. And again, we have our live blog going on. We'll hear from more reaction from some of our listeners on what's gone on this week and these past couple of months with the trial. And then we'll move into the situation in the city of Miami. Very interesting situation developing there. A U.S. Department of Justice investigation out this week on police-involved shootings in black communities there. So we've got a lot to discuss, a lot on the table. We'll continue our discussion. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman, back in just a moment. And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back. It's the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, here with Craig Pittman of the Tampa Bay Times, Melissa Sanchez from El Nuevo Herald, Michael Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And your questions are welcome for the panel. You can email us with your first name and a location, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. We're also reachable on the phone line, 800-743-WLRN, and we are tweetable at WLRN. We also have a live blog discussion being hosted by our social media editor, Danny Rivero, at WLRN.org, and a discussion on our Facebook page as well. We have our webpage discussion at WLRN.org. Now, here's a comment we received from the Public Insight Network from Chip in Hollywood.
I just wanted to say that the race card that's been played by too many people in this case is just a bad thing. This wasn't a race issue until the race card was played. This should have just been a simple self-defense issue where a man was attacked, there was a fight, there was a shooting, now there's a trial. Race has nothing to do with this.
Mike, you got your hands up.
That's just...
I think that's just wishful thinking on that caller's part. I mean, race has, as much as we don't want it to be, but it has everything to do with this case. Because, you know, when I went to the barbershop this morning, people were saying, you know, they said, look, we can't get in George Zimmerman's mind, but he says things like, you know, them and those people, and, you know, and he's going out with a loaded gun that was already had the bullet in the chamber. It was already locked, you know, it was ready to go. And he's like, if he had seen a white teen walking down the street, would he have had that same response? And I can't get in George Zimmerman's head. The jury's going to try to have to. But, you know, that's kind of some of the key questions there is if Trayvon was white walking in that neighborhood, would George Zimmerman reacted the same way?
Now, we've heard about self-defense, but we've not heard a lot about the stand your ground law. It has not been used, really, by the defense in this trial. But it's in the backdrop here because people, since this happened last in February of 2012, have been talking about how this might affect this verdict. But has it really been a factor?
I guess not. I mean, they haven't really invoked it. They're using more of just the standard self-defense claim, which is when somebody's in a fight and has a reasonable fear of you know, imminent grave bodily harm, that they can defend themselves. And this is what, you know, the crux of this case is going to come down to. Did he fire that shot in self-defense, or was he on top and acting as an aggressor and just point-blank shoot Trayvon Martin? And then that would raise it to the level of either manslaughter, or if the state proves that he acted with ill intent and the depraved mind, then it will rise to the level of second-degree murder. I don't know.
All right, Eric is in Doral, and he has a question about the stand your ground law. Eric, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for taking my call. One of the things that I am concerned about is beyond Trayvon Martin's case is the next case. And with the stand your ground law and people not having to retreat, as it were, that you are able to stand your ground, what is to prevent the next George Zimmerman from hunting, or however you want to characterize it, the next Trayvon Martin, and being able to use that defense of, well, it was self-defense because I was standing my ground and I have the right to.
I think that, you know, this is some of the questions that legislators have raised, but there's been no inclination to change the law. I think it's a fairly simple fix where you just have to insert language into that law saying that anybody who acts as an aggressor or escalates a situation or in some way provokes a confrontation should not be able to, you know, use this statute. And I think, you know, in this case, you would be able to have some... the facts would maybe show that George Zimmerman was clearly acting as an aggressor or provocateur just by going out of his truck.
All right, Eric, thanks very much for your call. Now, Craig, you cover Tallahassee stuff too. We know this was not talked about much in Tallahassee this year. It doesn't look like they're going to change the law in any way. But is there a perception that maybe one day down the line that they'll be able to insert the type of language that Mike was just talking about to maybe fix some of the confusion?
Well, next year is an election year, so I sincerely doubt it.
There you go. All right, one more call on this, and then we're going to move on to some City of Miami issues. Mike, you wanted to interject something?
Well, because we're going to go into those City of Miami issues, and it was interesting because one comment I heard this morning was that another complicating factor adding to the whole, you know, I guess, environment of unease is that this report was released this week,
right,
that found some fault with the City of Miami police and use of force. And that's kind of one more, you know, thing to throw into the simmering cauldron that you know, everybody has their fingers crossed, but it might be one more element that kind of sparks a fire.
Yeah, timing is everything on that, and Melissa Sanchez will talk about that in just a moment. One final call on this from Dwight in Fort Lauderdale has been waiting. Dwight, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hey guys, how you doing? You know, I was homesick with pneumonia, and I had a chance to watch a lot of the trial. And one aspect of it that just raised some real questions for me is there was one exchange during the trial where they were really going back and forth about his holster being on his right-hand side. The arriving officer said over and over again, because he was asked repeatedly over and over again, are you sure it was on his right hip? Yes, it was on his right hip. Are you sure? And I'm like, you know, okay, fine. We got it down. It's on his right hip. And that really wouldn't be a real bone of contention. But when they cut away, I observed that George Zimmerman's left-handed. So as a shooter, you wouldn't have your holster on your non-dominant side. And on top of that, you know, did they ever do any GSR tests on to find out, you know, which hands were actually used to fire the weapon? Because reaching across your body to draw your sidearm is really only a Hollywood thing.
What is a GSR test?
Gunshot residue, you know, okay. To find out which hand actually fired the weapon. Hmm. You know, I have a gun in my house, and, you know, and it's ready to go. But, you know, any shooter, a novice or even expert, as soon as you chamber a round, I don't care how experienced you are, blood pressure level definitely rises. And I'd be curious to know when and exactly he actually did, charge his firearm. You know, did he do it as he was leaving his house? Did he do it, you know, when he was exiting his truck? Did he do it as he was walking down that
hallway? You mean when he chambered that bullet? Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because that's one thing. I was talking to a couple of gun owners in the barbershop this morning, and they were all like saying, "I would never chamber the bullet until I'm ready to go to combat, until I know I have to use it." And they were all surprised that it was already chambered. I don't know what that means. And it's a very interesting observation you made about the left-handedness, because I noticed it too, because I'm a lefty, and I saw that, but I didn't even put two and two together with the whole. The gun being holstered behind his right hip. I don't know what it all means, but it is
the only reason I have my weapon ready to go is my wife. I just don't want to live with the guilt knowing that she was not able to charge that firearm if she ever had to use it. So we just keep it ready to go, and I tell her just to retreat to the bedroom. Anyone comes through that door, let the dog on him. He will give his life to give you those seconds to save yours. And that's pretty much my comment.
Well, Dwight, thanks very much for your call. Very interesting stuff and some very interesting observations there, as Mike mentioned. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, reintroducing our panel. Melissa Sanchez with El Nuevo Herald. We're going to talk about the city of Miami, and there are plenty of things going on there, as we just previewed for you, talking about the Justice Department investigation in just a moment. Michael Mayo's columnist with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Craig Pittman is with the Tampa Bay Times, and he'll be discussing weird Florida. We're going to shift gears and talk, although doesn't have to go too far here to kind of talk about this. We talked about the timing, Melissa, of this U.S. Department of Justice investigation into 33 police-involved shootings in the city of Miami, which this week uncovered what the feds call a pattern of excessive force. Now, if you remember, this investigation began in November 2011 after police officers shot and killed seven black Miami residents within the space of a few months. And we talked about the timing. This is amazing that this came out this week. What were the Justice Department's findings on this?
Well, essentially, this started after the shootings of the seven police officers, of the seven black men, mostly in Overtown, Liberty City, and those neighborhoods. And those all took place under the former police chief, Miguel Exposito. And he had set up these specialized tactical units, which were criticized heavily by leaders in the black community because they would go into neighborhoods undercover in vehicles that were unmarked. Supposedly, on some occasions, the police officers weren't in uniform, and they would go after bad guys. They would try to make arrests. And I remember for one of the shootings that took place on January 1st, 2011, I was working that day. It's a holiday. And I remember that early that morning, a guy in Overtown was killed who was wanted for I forget what. His name's Lynn Weatherspoon. And the folks in that neighborhood said that cops had shown up in black SUVs, that they were unmarked, and that this guy said, according to witnesses, and you can never really trust everybody, that the police started shooting at him. And this guy shot back because he thought it was another gang who was going after him. And so that's one of the things that the feds decided that Miami police shouldn't have been doing. Now, during this time period, Miami's mayor was paying a lot of attention to the police department, but not because of these shootings. He was paying attention because he was in a fight with the police chief, Exposito, over the illegal gambling machines,
the maquinitas. Yeah.
And as a result, there was all this public attention on whether the maquinitas were legal or not. Exposito was claiming that that the mayor was trying to bribe him to leave office. And meanwhile, his cops are shooting all sorts of poor black men. And so this report from the Department of Justice is a criticism also not just of the former police chief, but of the whole administration in Miami. And now that's become a campaign issue, because why was the mayor not paying attention to what was happening in the police department and instead focusing on the soap opera spat of the Maquinitas? But the DOJ had investigated the police department about a decade ago for similar issues.
Right.
They did not find this pattern of excessive force, even though there was a similar circumstance. But this time, the Department of Justice expressed kind of disgust that after 10 years, you guys still haven't gotten your act together. So this time, we're going to make you sign a binding commitment to change what's going on and have a federal judge oversee this. So even though there have been some changes made in the past year and a half since Exposito left, the Department of Justice wants this to be put in writing. So no matter who the police chief is or who the mayor is, that the cops will stop doing this.
Deputy Assistant Attorney General Roy Austin says the review raises several concerns, as Melissa just mentioned, about the role of the Miami Police Department specialized units. The teams often use undercover officers driving unmarked cars.
When you have people running to the scene who are not identified as officers, the people who the officers are attempting to apprehend don't necessarily understand the situation that is happening, and you end up in a situation that becomes more dangerous than it necessarily has to be.
And so, illustrating your point from before, and the former police chief Exposito, who's under the watch of many of these killings took place, what did he have to say about these findings?
Mike has always defended the use of the tactical units. He says that he doesn't understand, he doesn't think the Department of Justice understands how dangerous these neighborhoods are, and he still believes that this is what needed to be done in order to reduce crime. He also criticizes the Department of Justice for never having interviewed him during this investigation, and he thinks it's political, that at the end of the day, this is going to help out the mayor, Tomás Regalado, who had wanted to oust him for a while. Who knows? He says he's going to be writing to the Department of Justice to file his complaints about the report.
The Miami Herald this week called it a scathing and well-documented indictment of institutional failure regarding the use of force by Miami's officers in the line of duty. In Broward County, Mike, from the perspective that you have at the Sun Sentinel, how is this seen outside of Miami?
Well, you know, as far as in Broward itself, you know, we've had waves of where we've seemed to have trigger-happy cops that were, you know, there would be some shootings and you know, the amazing thing to me is, I guess I was talking to one of the, it might have been public defender Howard Finkelstein, but he was saying that, I guess in the 30-something year history that Mike Satz has been the state attorney in Broward, there's never been a conviction or I think even a prosecution for a bad shoot by a cop. And that's kind of astounding because, you know, I grew up in New York and, you know, we all understand police have very difficult jobs. They have to make very life and death decisions in a very short amount of time. But, you know, sometimes there are cases where a shooting should maybe not have occurred. And sometimes there's cases where it was clearly, an excessive use of force. And they should face beyond just internal sanctions, but also criminal prosecution. But, you know, that happens in New York sometimes, but it's never happened in Broward.
Yeah, and it's actually happening right now where they're having a discussion about racial profiling in the New York City Police Department.
Yeah.
Craig, being in Tampa, I guess you're even further away from all of this, but do these type of incidents happen in the Bay Area we know of?
Of course. In fact, we actually had one case that I can remember where our state attorney's office here attempted to prosecute a police officer from Clearwater who had shot a man who was not only unarmed, he was actually naked. And the jury acquitted and said, you know, we believe the police officer thought he was doing the right thing and was in fear of his life. And so he was absolved of that. And they have not prosecuted anyone since then that
yeah,
I'm aware of.
And juries usually give great deference to, you know, on-duty police officers doing their job because they understand how difficult it is. But the other, on the bright side, a lot of the local police agencies have moved forward in terms of a situation like that. We're dealing with a naked man who might be, you know, mentally disturbed. A lot of them now have, you know, the use of the tasers, and they have these highly trained crisis intervention teams that are equipped to deal with specific cases of those who are mental illness and psychotic and all that.
I know. In the backdrop, as Melissa just mentioned, there is this mayor's race in Miami between the incumbent Tomas Regalado, his challenger, the commissioner Francis Suarez, his son of the former Miami mayor and now Miami-Dade commissioner Xavier Suarez. That sounds like one of the big issues that's going to come up here before the election. What are some of the other big issues, Melissa, that we'll be hearing about? And has this race really gotten much attention?
I think it's starting to get attention. They're definitely raising a lot of money. The new reports just came out, and I think Francis has something like $500,000 in his campaign, $850,000 in his ECO, his electioneering communication.
Much more than the mayor has.
Much more than the mayor has. He has about twice as much. About twice as much. And other issues that are coming up, Regalado is criticized for having a lot of turnover in his administration. There have been, I don't know how many finance directors, CIP directors in the past 3 years. A lot of people leave. They say that it's difficult to hire CPAs into the finance department because nobody wants to risk it. There's an SEC investigation that's still pending. The IRS is also investigating. These aren't things that Tomás Regalado caused, but he hasn't been able to hire many people who inspire confidence. And there's issues in terms of how well the city's being administered. But Tomás hasn't made any major failures or hasn't done anything that's super wrong. So all that Francis can really criticize him on is all this turnover and the lack of leadership. However, Francis hasn't really presented any history. He hasn't been able to point to things that he's done and say that, you know, any examples. He's voted with Tomás on a lot of issues.
And yet the city commission the rest of the city commission is supporting Suarez, right?
Yeah, he's got the support of three of his colleagues. He's got the support of Michelle Spence-Jones, Mark Sarnoff, and Willie Gore. Frank Arroyo, whose brother used to be the mayor, has basically indicated he won't be weighing in, but he also is seeking a re-election.
So ancestral, the city of Miami with all these names coming back. That's Melissa Sanchez. She's with the El Nuevo Herald, Michael Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Craig Pittman. We're going to hand the spotlight over to Craig in just a couple of minutes. He's got this wonderful series on Slate.com about weird Florida, and we'll get into why Florida might be the weirdest place on earth. First, though, when we come back from this brief break, we'll talk about some of the new laws and why your cell phone might be illegal in the state of Florida. That and more as we continue our discussion on the Florida Roundup in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Good to have you with us. Melissa Sanchez from El Nuevo Herald is with us, as well as Michael Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times. If you want to reach us, we do have our live blog happening at WLRN.org, being fostered by our social media editor, Danny Rivero, in the other room, and also the Facebook page, Florida Roundup on WLRN. Like us there. The conversation continues when we get off the air, and we're also all active on Twitter. I'm at Phil Latzman. Melissa, what's your Twitter handle?
M. Sanchez, M-I-A.
Mike?
At Hey Mike Mayo.
And Craig?
At Craig Times.
All right. So July 1st, the new laws went into effect around Florida. One of them had to do with the red light cameras, which is also, Melissa, to put on this, to put a sort of a fine point on in the end of this conversation about the Miami's mayor's race, that has gotten involved here in the city of Miami about these red light cameras. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's become a big issue on the radio in Spanish, especially. Well, what the law did was it's requiring all municipalities that currently have these red light cameras systems to create a sort of a pellet body that can listen to any complaints that people have who've gotten ticketed. And so all municipalities are supposed to have these in place by July 1st. And if they don't have them, then their program essentially is invalidated or it's going against state law. So the city of Miami considered this item a couple of weeks ago, but the commissioners complained that they hadn't gotten enough information about it in time, and so they deferred the item until Thursday. And Francis Suarez has taken this, it has become a campaign issue, and he says that he's not only against creating these systems, these municipal appeals boards, but that he's against the whole red light camera system.
And he's gotten a couple of red light
tickets. So. He was not happy by that. Those stories this week, the Miami Herald reported that he got two tickets recently and he hasn't paid one of them. And it's very convenient that the company that runs the red light camera program leaks this information. Yeah,
but okay, and I'm gonna in his defense. One of those tickets, which is, remains unpaid, was before it became state law, and it was just cities administering it on their own and in ways that were often
arbitrary.
Well,
we've all gotten these red lights. I mean, all of us.
Not me yet. Well, cross my fingers. But here's the thing. There's two parts to these red light camera systems, and one of them I think everybody is on board with. Hey, if it prevents people from running through straight-ahead red lights at 30 miles per hour, great, because those are the idiots we want to stop. But it's now used as this kind of ticky-tack revenue collection device when people make these right-on-reds, slow-rolling right-on-reds, I call them, where they don't come to the full stop.
Right, that's where I got one of mine.
And that's what cities do a lot, especially on intersections where there's maybe a left turn arrow for the cross traffic, so you know that you're making a relatively safe turn, yet if you don't come to the full stop, they're going to still cite you. And you know, I know some cities have cut out the use of the right turns and don't cite for that anymore, but a lot of cities still do, and it's seen as a revenue grab, and that's where there's a lot of frustration coming in.
But just to clarify, in the city of Miami, they don't ticket you if you turn on red.
Yeah, places like Aventura, I know, and I think they don't do that
Boca
anymore.
Boca Raton, they do. Hallandale, they do.
So, Craig, how about up there? Is this a big an issue up in the Bay Area?
Good heavens, yes. in fact, our mayor here in St. Petersburg wanted to expand the red light camera system and neglected to mention to the city council that in addition to increasing the number of tickets, it had also increased the number of rear-end collisions as people were trying to slam on brakes now
right.
whenever the light changed.
And Craig, speaking of new laws, there was one law, you're talking about Zany, Florida, and Weird,
yes,
Florida, that this week we heard could have outlawed all electronics that connect to the Internet. What was this all about? Now, the cell phone that we are all using, for a while, there was a perception that that could be illegal for one of the unintended consequences of this new law. What's that all about?
Well, if I'm thinking of the same one you are, it's the attempt to ban the Internet cafes, which a lot of the sheriff's offices were saying were illegal gambling operations anyway. And so the legislature passed this very sweeping law, and so now this lawsuit's been filed, arguing that the legislature overreached. Boy, they never do that, do they? And that they accidentally outlawed the Internet in Florida. So I guess we'll have to wait for a judge to rule on that. But in the meantime, it gives everyone a good chance to point at Florida and say, ha-ha, one more time.
Well, as your colleague on Slate, Katie Waldman, wrote that they didn't accidentally do this. I mean, if you have to read the whole thing to understand what the point she's trying to make, but it just kind of plays to the fact that these weird things do happen in Florida. Before we get into that, though, the Timely Justice Act, that's another thing that requires governors to sign death warrants 30 days after the Florida Supreme Court certifies that an inmate has exhausted all legal appeals. The governor also asked for clemency review. Do you think that it's a good thing that they're trying, Mike, to speed up these executions in Florida after people have been sitting on death row for 30 years, 20, 30, 40 years even in some cases?
I have mixed emotions about it because sometimes you end up getting exonerations or some things that, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing to have people sitting on death row for decades. But there is this tremendous backlog, and it does seem like a ridiculous system where if you are going to have a death penalty, how do you have, 400 people sitting on death row, some of them for 30, 35 years? If the law has already been carried out and the sentence has been meted out, then, you know, I guess get it over with.
There are a couple of people who have been sitting on death row for a very long time. Seth Penalver is one of the names. There's another guy that's been out there talking about how they would have been executed and they were later exonerated. And if this law had been in effect, they'd be dead and there'd be no recourse for them.
This is true. And that's one reason why maybe it isn't such a bad thing to have a very slow and deliberate system.
Is an easy fix for the system, but the legislature is unwilling to do that. And that is, we are, I think, the only state or one of only two states that allows a majority vote on the jury to recommend death. All the other states require a unanimous vote. If we were to change the law to require a unanimous vote by the jury in order to recommend death to the judge, then that would cut down the number of cases that get the death penalty, and that would make the appeal system work much more efficiently. Florida, all these death cases immediately go to the Florida Supreme Court on appeal. Florida Supreme Court justices have said that dealing with these death cases takes up 50 to 70% of their time. They have to read through the record. They have to sort through all the issues. That's where a major bottleneck is. If you send them fewer cases and only the ones where the jury clearly is convinced of the person's guilt and that they deserve death, then you're going to cut down the number of cases they have to deal with and the number of appeals, and that will speed things along. But the legislature won't do it, and when it has been brought up, they view that as being soft on crime.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup. Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times with us, as well as Michael Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Melissa Sanchez from El Nuevo Herald. I'm Phil Latzman. A few minutes left, and we're going to devote these few minutes to, or most of them at least, to the series that Craig is writing on Slate.com on why Florida is possibly the weirdest place on earth.
No possibly about it. It's definitely.
Okay. Well, and here is another good source on this. Miami Herald columnist and best-selling author Carl Hiaasen on why he uses Florida as a foil for many of his novels.
You can have two reactions to what happens in Florida. You can take it seriously and get depressed, or you can sit back and laugh at it, which is what most Floridians do, because it is a crazy place. It's an incredibly fast-growing place, dynamic, but it's also a freak show. And if you're a writer, and I'm a journalist and a novelist, it's the best show going.
And Craig, you're not exactly a carpetbagger, as you mentioned on Slate.com. Your family's been here since what, the
1850s? Yes, my family first moved here in 1850. I think looking for a good deal on waterfront condos. and so I've spent a lifetime observing, what life is like in Florida, and how, if you live here, you never suffer from an irony deficiency.
Hey, no kidding, yeah.
And I have my theory on why we're the weirdest. But, it's the old catch basin theory that, you know, the way the whole country is shaped, and where all the junk and the drip and the detritus flows to the bottom.
Coworker refers to us as the drain pipe of America. Yeah. But, I think there's more to it than that, too, that people come here looking for second, third, and fourth chances. O.J. Simpson got acquitted. He came here. And then got a ticket for speeding through a manatee zone. And so you have all these folks who are trying to leave the past behind, come here and make a fresh start. They've been told, in Florida the rules are different here, and somehow they hear that as we don't have rules at all. And so you have a lot of people trying to make a buck fast. You have people trying to get away from their past. You have the past reaching out to trip people up. I just did a story this past week about how the place where they want to build the new spaceport happens to already be occupied by 18th century archaeological dig that supposedly one of the most significant finds in North America. So you get this battle between the future of the Space Coast versus its past. So it's just, to me, it's the most interesting state in the Union and the most interesting place to live in the world.
Well, go ahead, Mike, quickly.
I was just going to say, talking about people reinventing themselves, just look at our governor. Here's a guy who, when he was running a major corporation, got tagged with the biggest fine penalty in the history of, Medicare for the fraud. Yeah. And then he comes back and says, I'm this great guy who's run a great business, and trust me to run your government, even though I've defrauded the government.
Well, there are many different ways. And now you can also, Chris Craig points out, in a study released last year, found that in the first decade of the century, from 2000 to 2010, Florida led all other states in total convictions of officials and staff who broke federal corruption laws. The tally is 781, and that beat the three more populous states, California, Texas, and New York. And then
it makes you proud, doesn't it?
You also talked about some of the wackiest state officials, including Florida Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Ron Bergeron.
Alligator Ron, yes. He's my absolute favorite public official right now because he got in trouble for wrestling an alligator. The alligator chomped on his hand. He wound up with stitches. The Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission sent an investigator out to talk to him about it. He showed him the medical records. He gave him a full statement. He actually went and shook hands with the president, and the president said, President Bush said, "What happened to your hand?" And he told him, "Well, I was wrestling an alligator." And the investigator presented all the evidence to the prosecutors in Hendry County, and they said, "No, we can't charge him. There's not enough evidence."
Well, Ron is a Broward guy, and he's one of my favorites because he's this conservation official,
colorful,
and he comes riding up to all these meetings in a gold-plated Hummer. So
yes, which he calls his cowboy Cadillac.
Now, I got to ask Melissa, because she hasn't been here as long as we have, and she's I think you're from Detroit, right?
Yep.
So, what was your, when you moved down here, and in your 3 or 4 years that you've been here, have you noticed is this the weirdest place on earth?
Sure seems like it. I mean, the stories never end. Just the other week, we had a new intern who was writing about, you know, one of these doctors who injects women's butts to make them bigger. This poor woman had died, so our intern was writing about it. She went to interview the family of this poor girl.
That's true. Craig, you didn't get that in there.
Oh,
yeah.
That's in the first one. We're a hotbed of fix-a-flat butt enlargers.
Yep. So you have that. It's already weird enough as it is, and I have this poor intern interviewing the family of this dead girl who died a couple of months ago, and I just to check our facts, I just looked up the victim's name in the federal court system, and of course, she had stiffed Medicare of $500,000.
Medicare fraud, too. There you go. So, Craig, this series that you have, it's actually really interesting. But what is the weirdest place in Florida? You in one of your stories, you talked about everybody seems to point to South Florida as being the weirdest place. So, but that's a pretty big region. But is there a specific place where all the weirdness seems to center around?
I went through the list of suspects. I started off with Key West, a.k.a. Key Weird, and talked about some of the things that have happened there. I talked about Miami, you know, with the Santeria priests leaving offerings on the courthouse steps and so forth, and then moved on to talk about, well, there's also some argument for the panhandle, where you have the city of Vernon known as Nub City because so many people cut off limbs as part of an insurance fraud scam. And then there's the Central Florida, where half the police department in Lakeland is currently under investigation in a sex scandal. But I think that by far the weirdest place in Florida is Pasco County, which is just
we're off the hook in South Florida.
Yes, it's just north of here. Just as far as consistently producing weird stuff, you know, they were a hotbed of mafia activity. That's where a lot of the Donnie Brasco action takes place. They now have lots of the nude resorts, and there's an ongoing battle between the nudists and the nude swingers that has cropped up in some county commission meetings. The Ku Klux Klan adopted a highway the people living along the highway were not happy about, even though the Klan swore they would not wear their robes, they would wear the, you know, the red safety vest. We have alligator attacks, we had a murder case involving a fetish model who was involved in a sex party slaying. I mean, it's just, for such a fairly rural area, it is constantly producing weird stories. And so I was arguing that Pasco County is by far the weirdest place in a very weird state.
I think good to hear.
I think Miami could, you could catch up if you try really hard.
I don't know. My nominee would be Tallahassee because a lot of weird stuff comes out of that state capital.
I did write about the fact that our state capitol building was voted the most phallic building in the world.
Yes, we weren't going to mention that, but the location of the Capitol and everything else is included in that story, too. All right, one little final call here, and we only have a few seconds for David and Kendall, who I think wants to capitalize on the weird conversation. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you all doing? I was thinking you were talking about the governor. What about the city of Hialeah, who elects officials who have been convicted?
That's Hialeah for you.
Florida for you, yeah.
And my favorite weird thing, well, I mean, it was the Kathy Willett story, which was, I guess, almost 2 decades ago. Yeah. But it was the wife of a Broward sheriff's deputy who was running a prostitution operation out of her home while her husband secretly videotaped all the proceedings. He was the cop. And then part of her client list included a vice mayor of Fort Lauderdale who was a, you know, religious conservative, one of those family values guys. And to me when she got charged, was represented by the late, great Ellis Ruman, who presented the nympho defense. That story had it all for me.
It had legs. It had legs. If you could have thrown in a python or an alligator, that would have been the perfect
one. We didn't even get to the invasive species situation. Craig, what are your upcoming stories that you have there quickly?
I've got one about what are the elements of a Florida weird story. That nudity is a plus, that it should involve some sort of odd weapon like a lawn gnome. Machetes are actually becoming somewhat of a cliche these days. But a lawn gnome, that's new. Anything involving animals, I mentioned alligators, pythons. I think the new hotness is llamas. We're seeing a lot of llama stories lately.
Well, I'm going to leave it there at the llamas because we're running out of time. Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times and Slate.com. Great series on Weird Florida. Mike Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Thank you, as always. And Melissa Sanchez, great to have you back from El Nuevo Herald. That does it for the Florida Roundup, Friday, July 12, 2013. We have it rebroadcast on this airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Stay tuned. We'll be updating you on what's happening in the Zimmerman trial and having reaction to it when that verdict does come down. Florida Roundup produced by Elaine Chen. Thanks also to Steph Farrow, Danny Rivero, our executive producer Peter J. Meritz, our intern Isabella Charte, and Paul Leary, our technical supervisor. South Florida Arts Beats next. It's Friday. Until next week, stay informed, South Florida.